ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Mike Green, Vice President of Marketing and Business Development for Bright Cove's Media Business. Bright Cove is the leading provider of cloud video services for delivering and monetizing video across connected devices. Mike looks after how Bright Cove communicates with their industry-leading media customers like Time Inc. and Viacom. He is responsible for the overall marketing strategy and execution, including partnership initiatives, marketing communications, demand generation, and field marketing in the Americas. Thank you so much for joining the program. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
For people in the audience who might not be aware about what Bright Cove is and does, can you give us the Cliff Notes version?
Sure thing. So we are a provider of solutions for cloud video. We've actually, been known for having created the category of OVP, online video platform, and that dates back to when the company was founded in 2004. When basically there wasn't much in the way of video on the web and you needed everything. So an end-to-end solution to get video on the web. But I kind of define it more loosely as a collection of cloud-based services now for delivering video, because there's less just one platform that everybody uses and more a collection of various tools that businesses ranging from media companies, you know, like a Viacom or a Time Inc. use, to things that brands use to live stream their fashion shows like a Hugo Boss or something. So it's a wide range of video cloud-based services that our customers use.
Right, right. So when we look at the entertainment industry, when, you know, we know that there are some pretty big trends that are going on. Box office revenue is down, linear television viewership is going down, streaming digital mobile viewership is up, and ad avoidance is continuing to cannibalize a lot of these media companies' potential profits, because these were, you know, originally sort of the revenue generator was through ads. How does Bright Cove's technology help solve some of these problems?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on some of the most important trends of our time that certainly when we think about our customers and the types of problems they're looking to solve for, we have to try and position our areas of investment to align with, you know, again, their goals. And, you know, I often think of it in terms of good news, bad news, and that, yes, you're right. Sometimes, you know, box office or first run viewing movies or first run of a TV show audience might be smaller, but there are more and more, you know, channels by which our customers can be successful distributing their content. And there are more and more hours of the day, frankly, that end users can be consuming video, whether it's, you know, on the bus on the way in, or you mentioned your train ride in. So with those opportunities, that's the part that's exciting. But the challenges I think that our customers are grappling with is how to successfully deliver video into all of those channels and opportunities, and how to do so in a way that is always high performance and, you know, kind of respectful of the brand and the effort they put into creating video. And also that the video can always be monetized in those circumstances, because, you know, advertising doesn't work easily in every environment. If it's a subscription model, you know, authentication doesn't always work easily in every environment. So, you know, I think that's kind of where we are today, is customers trying to recognize the changes in consumer behavior, take advantage of the opportunities that those changes have presented, and we have to be there for them with a range of solutions to, you know, enable their particular business models, always have it, you know, be an end experience that's high quality and consistent with their brand.
Well, that was actually, you segued beautifully into my next question, which is, to what extent do you think the behavioral trends are motivated by user experience?
Well, I mean, you mentioned ad blocking, right? And that's an interesting one, because the user experience that people have shown a huge proclivity for certainly is things like binge viewing and without ads. I mean, Netflix's numbers are through the roof. So whether it's customers looking to explore SVOD, subscription video on demand, in a way that they perhaps had not prior when they were a TV network, that's one thing that they say, look, I can tell my audience wants to consume my content in this way. If I can't show them ads, maybe there's an easy way to kind of have success along the lines of what Netflix is doing. So that's one thing. Or, you know, frankly, we've got customers who are focused on preserving the exchange that has always stood kind of for a fairly long time, is you know, a user's time. If they're going to get content for free, that time can also be monetized with advertising. And one of the ways, for example, that people deal with that when ad blockers are prevalent is by what we call server-side ad insertion, which is stitching ads into the content in the cloud, so on the server, such that the consumer's end device can't detect, oh, this is a request to Google for an ad, I'm going to block that. So there's kind of two paths that are certainly among many that people are thinking about in this current environment.
Right. It's interesting. We did a study last fall around ad blocking, and 2/3 of young millennials are ad blocking. And I'm sure it's probably increased. And what we had started looking at it thinking that it was related to piracy. Our entering hypothesis was people started pirating content. There are a lot of pop-up ads and they installed ad blockers as a result. And although we couldn't prove causality, we found that there was high correlations, and there was, if people were pirating on their mobile, their ad blocker was mobile. If they were pirating on desktop, their ad blocker was desktop. And so there was a high, I'm going to forget the word, but whatever that word is I'm looking for, it was that. And then they were, this young population, certainly my kids, for instance, were saying, gee, mom, that's really annoying. Why don't you just install this thing? And I'm like, you know what I do for a living? I can't install that thing. That would be wrong. I must suffer through all these ads. It's my duty.
Yeah. That actually reminds me of the Howard Stern moment, where Howard Stern didn't realize he could do that. And when he, on his show, was like, oh my gosh, I can just block ads that simply. And it caused a huge spike in ad blocking. I don't know, maybe this was 2015, but yeah, it remains a hot topic. And what's been interesting is watching all the different ways that, media content owners have tried to have a dialogue with their audience. I mean, certainly publishers like Forbes and Conde say, hey, this is how we are able to generate this content that you really like. Please whitelist us, or we'll provide you an ad light experience. I mean, this dialogue is a constant ongoing one. And you're also right about who the audience is that is more likely to be interested in blocking ads. And that's a young male tech savvy audience, the kind of audience you find on, gaming sites. One of our customers at the gaming site had, I think, in that range you're talking about, 70% or so ad blockers. And when they detect an ad blocker present, they actually switch, in the context of a desktop browser, they switch to stitch the ad in server side so they can preserve the inventory they need to run their business.
That's really interesting. We actually didn't find a gender variance between
them. Interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting, because that was also, I thought that I would, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. What was also interesting was the level of, attitude. They were totally fine with what they were doing. The piracy and the ad blocking they thought was awesome. So changing behaviors, which people don't feel are wrong, is a challenge for sure. It's interesting, stitching it in, that is great. That's a great solution. And certainly when we were testing to see how many people had like ad block walls or different methods, one of the things we found were some older sites, obviously not the type of site that you would deal with, where it was baked into the video.
Like hard-coded into the...
Yeah, exactly, that it was more effective. And so by being really low tech, they had succeeded.
Well, you know what? I mean, you may call this low tech, right? But what were soap operas other than kind of sponsored content where the advertiser was tied right into the content? And frankly, in an era where so many of the video views are taking place on Facebook, that hasn't really provided a great set of options for monetization. People who do branded content in that environment are doing pretty well. And so that's certainly a hot topic in terms of a way that people can, deliver perhaps a better user experience. There are challenges, of course, with scaling branded content maybe, but Facebook is definitely an important outlet for that content right now.
Do you work with Facebook?
We do. Facebook's an important partner to Brightcove. I mean, my world here is running marketing and business development for the media business. And the reason those two things go together, frankly, is if you're marketing a story of, the company and how it can help its customers, the solution is incomplete if it doesn't speak to, well, the customer wants to use this ad server from Google or Freewheel, or this analytics platform, analytics from Nielsen or Comscore or Chartbeat, or have their video successfully play, nicely with Facebook. And so we have had a partnership with Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, even though sometimes those companies have solutions that can overlap with ours, but we've always had good relationships. We have a product called Brightcove Social, for example, that if, Brightcove is the mission control for our customers and how they think about their video businesses, it has to be mission control, not just for their O&O, but also for when that video lives off of their site and on Facebook and elsewhere. So it's a module where you can schedule, publishing for your own site, but also to YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and get back all those analytics that those platforms make available to you, whether it's retweets, favorites, shares, likes, and that sort of thing. So it's an important part. I mean, they to their credit, those platforms make APIs available that that companies like Brightcove have to build to enable the workflows that are efficient for our our customers. And, you know, prior to those solutions being available in the market, I mean, we hear from customers, you know, a gentleman from Barstool Sports, one of our customers, you know, said, we used to take our mezzanine asset, which is like the big heavy video file, put it into Video Cloud, compress it, use it on our own site, then download it out of Video Cloud where it would be smaller and would more quickly go into Facebook. And then I'd go log into Facebook, upload that video. It just was very inefficient.
Oh, yeah.
And so the idea that you can put it into Video Cloud for your own sites and then just hit publish and have it go to those other platforms is a time saver.
Well, it was interesting. I was reading your firm's recent, I think it was manifesto for 2017, and it had some statistics which were, you know, really bang you over the head. And it was that video traffic was 70% of all internet traffic and that it would surpass 80% by 2020. And that's amazing, really. Yeah. And so, and then, but there was the giant but, certainly on, you know, and the consumer demand for online video and great content options, but that 85 cents on each incremental dollar, ad dollar, goes to Google or Facebook. And yeah. Like that, I guess, how much do they sort of say to you, this is how it's going to be? And if they're competing with you, I mean, is that, how do you, when they're that big, how does that work?
Well, it's an interesting question. First of all, thank you for reading the manifesto. I mean, we took a lot of time and thought into that document. It's just been a really good North Star for our media business and how we serve our customers. And
it's a great document. Okay. I was like, oh, just say all these things. That'll be great.
Well, the duopoly point, frankly, there's some challenges that we talk about in the manifesto that are easier to address than the duopoly. I don't think anybody really has an answer in the industry for the duopoly, although you see things like, you know, newspapers, even who compete with one another, all sorts of media organizations banding together to, you know, try and offer scale that can somehow compete with the scale that those platforms have.
Right.
Or saying, you know, asking for exemptions from, I think, like the FTC to, you know, be able to bargain as a collective or whatever it is. Like, those types of stories are really interesting because you're right. It leaves everybody else who has great content fighting for scraps if all the monetization takes place on Facebook and YouTube.
Right.
But I can tell actually one interesting story. I mean, I think the point really is that media companies aren't standing pat though and saying, well, what was us? You know, UK TV is a customer of ours, as you might expect, in the UK. And they talked about how, look, you know, we've been a broadcaster with a great audience for a long time, but we don't know the same things about our audience that obviously Facebook does or Google does, given the activities that our audience engages in on those platforms, identifying themselves and saying what they like. And so interestingly, UK TV took the step of asking, and they're sort of doing this right now, asking their audience to authenticate. Even though the audience is not being asked to pay for the service, the audience is just being asked at one point when they go to use UK TV Play, which is like their long form catch-up service, mm-hmm. They're saying, you know, just tell us, you know, who you are, your age bracket, you know, allowing them to basically be segmented for the purposes of better targeted advertising. Because if that's what advertisers are looking for, and one of the reasons that advertisers go buy, you know, on Facebook and Google, you know, these broadcasters have long not known these same things about their audience, and they're taking steps to get better about that. So, I mean, that's just a small, and what was so interesting, because actually Ollie Davies, who's the head of that product, was presenting at our customer conference about this topic. And he said, look, we have to get the user experience right when we start changing the way that users have interacted with us for so long, right? Because they used to just flip it on and, you know, their show fires up.
I was going to say, because, you know, user experience are all the issues of user experience, are all of them equal? I mean, in that manifesto, you talk about load time. Mm-hmm. And similarly, it's like the time it takes for me to get to the stuff I want, if I've got to enter who I am and where, I, you know, what demographic I am, that's going to make me annoyed. I am easily annoyed. I discover I'm more and more easily annoyed. I've become a goldfish in my ability to become annoyed. I, you know, on sites that are retail sites, or somebody posts an article and I want to look at the article and it says, oh, just put in your email. And I think, I don't want to do that.
Fair question. I think these guys are only asking you to do it once, and then you're going to be a repeat user of that service for a long time because it's got shows that you love. But, you know, they do expect, I think, that'll cut into overall stream volume initially as they get people through this, and they're giving people a grace period. You don't have to do it day one, but they think it is an important step. And you're right also just about the expectation of users generally that video, if it's the same videos that they've been seeing on TV, they expect that content to start up and play just as quickly, you know, in a digital environment. And so we're constantly, you know, benchmarking our, for example, our web player to ensure that it starts up just as quickly as any other, you know, situation where somebody might try to consume that video.
It actually goes a little faster, doesn't it? It seemed like when I was looking at those bar charts.
I'm glad that. So we are constantly benchmarking to ensure that we're the fastest player in the industry, and then also that it's easy to work with from our you know customers' perspectives. I mean, we go find external development shops and say, hey, you know, please kick the tires on this. Tell us, you know, are the APIs flexible? Is the documentation good? You know, come back with your honest opinion. And we have to constantly benchmark because it's a, you know, it's an exciting but competitive industry. So we always have to be, you know, user friendly to our end audience.
So if I'm a customer of yours, is it something you build and it's sort of white labeled? So it's the skin is all mine. It looks like it's mine, or does my player look the same as another player? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the player itself is HTML5, JavaScript, and CSS, which means it's basic web technologies that a good number of developers are comfortable with customizing. And people like to customize the player to match their brand and to be, you know, it's always responsive, you know, responsive design. So there are a lot of things that are kind of, you know, I would say, frankly, table stakes to allow someone to create the user experience look and feel that matches their brand. But kind of the tool set for how you do that, how extensible, for example, a player can be, meaning can you add plugins that do 360, or can you, you know, right? All those types of elements of the user experience are kind of where the arms race is. You know, people want to offer 4K to their end users. People want to offer, you know, this isn't a web player experience, but they want to offer download to go for their customers if they're an SVOD service because Netflix offers it and Amazon Prime offers it. From a user experience perspective, those are the types of things that we're constantly trying to innovate and offer our customers so they can offer their end users.
Right. And so I guess, is there again, to get to the question, is there a hierarchy among these user experience things? Is that something that you're conducting research on the consumer market and what people want? So you inform and educate your customer and say, like, these are the things, these are the, as you say, table stakes. If you don't do them, you're not even a player. Now, then this is the hierarchy and this is sort of what you know, and if you want to be best in class, these are the things you have. How do you assess those things?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we have the good fortune of a really rich community of customers who are putting out great user experiences and examples, and we share them across the company so that, you know, as a team, we're always educated about, hey, you know, TV New Zealand just launched their catch-up service in that market that is available on Chromecast with server-side ad insertion with DRM, which is a combination of technologies that maybe at that time none of our other customers had put together and pulled off. Like, people are always pushing the envelope, and they're trying to say, look, our audience in this market cares a lot about Chromecast. We've got customers in Japan who want to make sure that their service works across like 8 versions of a Wii that we've never even heard of here in this market. You know? Yeah. So it is, you know, what is table stakes sort of differs by market, by content type. We just try and share as much as we can across the company best practices. In our customer conference play, thankfully the customers come themselves and share what they're doing and how it's working for them.
Do you guys have a formalized mechanism where these best practices from one region to another are shared? Or is that just organic? You happen to know the guy, and so you chat.
Well, internally, there's an alias, customer examples, which every time some new great service launches, people write up what it is, how they accomplished it, and, you know, if the customer's willing, of course, we get to sometimes do blog posts or case studies, and that stuff, of course, is more publicly available. We've got, you know, video case studies, which we should be drinking our own champagne or eating our own dog food, of course. And so those are on the website. And again, I mentioned play. And to me, that's like, you know, something as you know, being in a marketing role, I put a lot into that show. And I really love how much our customers contribute because they come prepared to explain, you know, as Ollie did, how he thought about authentication for his service. And TV New Zealand guys, I'm sorry, the MediaWorks guys, who are also in New Zealand, actually came and talked about how when they used server-side ad insertion, they did it to reach, you know, older devices and dumb devices that can't do client-side ads and all these things. And that, for them, grew their inventory significantly. And I see people in the room, our other customers, taking notes about the results that these customers are willing to share. Trinity Mirror, for example, was at the conference, and they talked about, you know, we knew we needed to get better at the viewability of our video on our site. So for people who aren't familiar with the term viewability, it has to do with, you know, an advertiser wants to ensure, of course, that their ads are seen and not, you know, that the user has scrolled down the page while the video player is playing up at the top. So Trinity Mirror did a bunch of A-B testing about what the right way is to incorporate a floating player that goes down the page next to the user, but that's also not, you know, obnoxious, and they got their viewability rate up. And hearing a customer tell that story and other customers in the room being able to take notes or then approach them after, I mean, that's really valuable. And it's valuable for me too, certainly as someone who is part of a team here that's constantly thinking about where should we invest to innovate, to make solutions that matter.
Right, right. How, when you are looking at the landscape of change that's coming, do things like voice tech, for instance, is that something that's already being, you know, folded into how will that affect our stuff, or will it not affect you, or how do you look at the future, and what is the timeline you look at?
That's a great question. You know, certain things we have more ability to make use of than others. I mean, you know, I'm an X1 customer. Comcast set-top box at home was the first voice-controlled remote I had. But of course, you can search your phone with your voice and then Chromecast something. And so there are different kind of pieces that are available to someone like Brightcove. And we may or may not be frankly involved in building the app. The customer may, you know, have Brightcove software and build something, or we may be involved in helping them build it. But one thing we did offer is Amazon's Show, Echo Show product. We have a quick turnkey solution to help you have your video content on Show, which is a new thing, of course, that does leverage some of that voice technology.
Fantastic. Yeah. I think that's really interesting.
But it's a challenge to stay abreast of every new thing that's going to come out. You know, if I think this is a long time ago that the when the iPad came out, I think New York Times was a Brightcove customer at the time and had an app on that iPad that Steve Jobs said, look, this app better be ready for my demo and play video. And getting the early heads up, right, was really important for Brightcove to make sure that we would prepare a solution with the customer that would work in that context. It was very valuable for
high
all parties.
Stakes, though, yeah. I mean,
so, but it's like that all the time.
Exposure,
you know?
Oh my goodness.
Facebook F8 has that. You know, the I/O from Google has that. You know, Apple has their own event coming up this fall at some point. You know, Apple News is innovating. You know, we're all over Google AMP. We're all over Facebook Instant Articles. These things are, you know, it's exciting, but it's exhausting, right?
Right. And how do you pick? I mean, there's only so many hours in the day. What do you think is the most, what has been the most challenging situation that you've had to tackle?
I mean, what we were just talking about a little bit is the proliferation of devices and platforms that our customers need to get to. And, you know, that's part of the manifesto where, you know, I think thankfully we're, as a business, you know, video generally, I think people have gotten a little bit past the crawl, walk, run stage. It's about, if this is replacing, you know, the pay TV ecosystem that's been so lucrative for so long, people are nervous about how can I do it with the same level of profitability and success in the digital world going forward. And that's where the manifesto is talking about, okay, you're in these places. Can you do it smarter? You know,
well, right. It was, you know, 50% more revenue, 50% less cost, and wowza experience or something like that, right?
Well, that's, yeah, user experience is right, the third pillar of that. And I think we had to try and set high benchmark goals for ourselves in those areas. I mean, frankly, your results may vary. I mean, because if you're not doing DRM content, no, I mean, I'm being candid about this. I mean, the cost saving side really is dictated by what kind of content you have and what type of business you're running. Because, you know, if I can give an example of that, we have something called dynamic delivery that's designed to allow you to create way fewer renditions or number of versions of a video at the time of ingest, which will save you a lot on storage, and then it can be more efficient when it comes to delivery. Because instead of what used to happen was someone would, you know, every video within a Netflix or a service like that would have to get prepared in a number of different formats at a number of different bit rates with a number of different content protection schemes for all the places that it might get played back. Now, to way oversimplify, you know, the file comes in once and that, you know, gets, you know, put into a few different bit rates, but at the time of playback, when we know what the device is that's trying to access the content, we just in time package it and wrap it for that end device. So this is kind of in the weeds, mind you, but these you know, technical innovations.
That's a tech innovation that you guys have done.
That's right. Yeah.
Yep. That's amazing. I mean, and you can do it speedy enough that it's going to hit that load rate. I mean,
wow. Yeah. I mean, it's been deployed by some of the, you know, most interesting, biggest OTT services that I can't talk about around the world. So that's exciting. Yeah.
Very impressive people. Well, that's amazing. What do you think are there any, I guess, sort of looking ahead, if you were to say, you know, what are you watching or what worries you or what excites you, what would you point to?
It's kind of a macro topic, but I think what worries me is that the ad experience is still pretty broken, which kind of to back to the beginning of our conversation is why people are acting blocking the way they are.
Right.
And if every piece of content has to be paid for in an SVOD model like a Netflix, then that hurts access to content for a large portion of the population. And, you know, people need to have access to information. And if news organizations can't publish quality video and quality journalism and have it supported by ads, that's a problem. So I think one of the things we can do to help, you know, discourage people's need to put ad blockers on their browsers and phones and so forth is by making the ad experience better. And, you know, that has to do with respecting the user without overwhelming interstitials and pop-ups and things. And, you know, we're constantly trying to figure out if there's a better way to do certain things, like, you know, there's a standard called VPaid that's prevailed for a really long time to help customers do viewability. And frankly, it can be abused in a lot of ways, and it can break people's video streams. And it's for someone like you who said, look, I get impatient when I can't tell what's going on and why my content's not available to me. There's all number of situations like that that we need to, across the industry, collaborate on to ensure that the ad-supported model is healthy, because I think it has a lot to do with whether people can access the content that they deserve to be able to access.
Well, I guess the thing that you can't control a bit is what is the ad you're inserting, right? I mean, and the challenge is that if people do have the ability to skip an ad or have an ad blocker, it's not just the way the ad shows up and floats or exists. It's the fact that it's the same Geico ad that you've seen a million times. I mean, how much in terms of your control of the experience of the ad insertion do you say, look, you know, it can be this many times, but no more. We're not going to serve the same one because it will hurt your customer? Or do you get into that with them in terms of showing them the benefits of the content they're putting in?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the logic that dictates that's more at the ad server level than at the Brightco level. But if, for example, there's proper measurement on an Xbox, let's say, when someone's viewing there, then more advertisers would be willing to run their ads there, which gives a greater set of choices for the ad server, so that it's not just, well, Geico's comfortable there. It's the only campaign that's willing to run on Xbox. Therefore, every time you watch a long form episode of, you know, I don't know, Breaking Bad on the Xbox, you're getting the same Geico ads over and over again. You know, as we make the ecosystem more willing to run advertising in more situations and getting them the proper measurement in those environments, that'll help. And being able to implement what we call universal frequency capping, meaning knowing that it was you, Gabriella, across all these platforms, and then you've already seen your share of that Geico ad.
Poor Geico. The example for sort of everything. Well, you know, I've really run through our time. It's gone really, really fast. It's been so fun. Before I end, I always like to just go through a list of words, top of mind, response. I always find it interesting how different people react. So you ready to play my game?
All right, I'll try.
Okay, Facebook.
Powerful.
Google.
Information.
Snapchat.
Sizzle.
Ooh. Twitter.
Vital.
YouTube.
Fun.
Ad blockers.
Inevitable for now.
Art.
Emotion.
VR.
Promising.
AR.
More promising than VR.
AI.
Applicable in so many ways.
Huh. You know, it's one of the things I love is I had interviewed somebody earlier today, and when I asked them about Twitter, they said over. And it's so interesting, the different ways we feel about these platforms. And, you know, I forgot to ask you about Snapchat, but we've run out of time, so I'll have to.
Well, you know, you said Snapchat, and I said Sizzle. And actually, Snapchat's a Brightcove customer, and Snapchat Discover is powered by Brightcove, and the way they make video appear so fast in so many different ways is a revolutionary experience. And so I do think it has sizzle and it's exciting, you know, despite the constant, you know, what's going to happen to them given the pressure from Instagram and all that. Like I think it's sexy still.
Yeah, no, it's very cool. And I actually had these scribbled notes to myself. I was meant to ask you about it, but then I just got caught up in in experience. So there you are. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Mike Green. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.